Turning back in the Word of God this morning to the book of Judges, the 7th chapter, and we are looking for just part of our text here, verse 4. Judges 7, and the 4th verse, we'll be considering the verses 1 right down through to 15 today, and the subject, when we are too big for God to use. When we are too big for God to use. Verse 4 then, "And the Lord said unto Gideon, The people are yet too many. Bring them down onto the water, and I will try them for thee there. And it shall be that of whom I say unto thee, This shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I say unto thee, This shall not go with thee, the same shall not go." Frenchman by the name of Emile Coon shot to fame in the early part of the 20th century. Why he did was this: he claimed that he had discovered and developed an almost infallible method of healing. His basic philosophy ran like this: when you're sick, if you keep telling yourself that you're really getting better, you could quite literally talk yourself out of your illness. You were given by him a little phrase to repeat 20 times in a row, twice a day. It was this: every day in every way, I am getting better and better. Every day in every way, I am getting better and better. Coot claimed that he had seen people cured of heart trouble, ulcers, bronchitis, bad nerves, and a multitude of other problems simply by adopting his method. Believe that you're getting better, and you will. Often you do, he argued. Emile Coo is just one of thousands of people in different walks of life who were convinced that all you need to do in life when you come up against problems and difficulties, trials and tribulations, is to put a good, strong, positive face upon it and instill a sense of self-confidence within you, and that will take care of every one of your problems. I used to receive leaflets through the post advertising Mind Power, urging me, see yourself in a new light, sharpen your skills, take control of your life, unlock your hidden talents, release your hidden strengths. And you would almost have felt with the regularity with which these were coming in that somebody somewhere, maybe a lot of people in those places, were trying to tell me something. Well, I haven't got any for quite some time, so I guess I've given up. If we can believe that we can, then we can do it. That is the basic philosophy. Now, I suppose in a different kind of way, in a refined part of this psychology, an athlete will psych himself up before a big contest comes. I was always quite staggered, I suppose, by watching Linford Christie as he went down on the starting line, got his feet into the blocks for the 100 metres, and the sheer concentration that was bulging out of his eyes was quite incredible. The manager will get into the dressing room there, and he'll stir up his players with an inspirational team talk. A sales manager will bring all of the others around, and he will conduct a motivation seminar. An army commander on the eve of battle will persuade his men that you cannot possibly lose. We can do it, boys. We've got the beating of them. Let's go and get them. However, there are limitations. I'm quite amused by the little satirical poem which runs, "He tackled the thing that couldn't be done. With a will he went right to it. He tackled the thing that couldn't be done. And he found he couldn't do it." Quite simply, no matter how we try to build up our own confidence, no matter what techniques we call into play to help us here, this motivational business does not always work. It's interesting to trace the method God uses when he sets about getting men and women ready to work for him. The Coos and the Churchills and the Jose Mourinhos and the Tim Collins of this world, they try to prepare their followers by pumping up their self-confidence, strengthening, fortifying their mind cells, stiffening their backbone. But God uses a different method entirely. Far from building up our self-confidence, he strengthens our dependence upon him. When God has a work to do for a man or a woman, he will go to that man and woman, and when they're doing something great for him, he will give them not self-confidence, but God-confidence. Judges chapter 7 is one example of this. And what a clear, even a classic example we have here. For in this passage, here is God, and he's preparing Gideon for battle against the hosts of the Midianites. But before that flag of victory is ever going to be hoisted over the camp of Israel, and they to return victorious, a lot of work had to be done. A great amount of preparation before the battle had to be made. And we're going to chart that preparation today. We're going to tune into Gideon's schedule, as we can trace it here through Judges 7, verses 1 to 15. Notice to begin with that there is here faith in the crucible. Faith in the crucible. Verses 1 to 8 tell us all about that. For the 8th consecutive year, those desert-dwelling bandits, the Midianites, had swept into the land of Israel at harvest time. This year, we're told in Judges 8 and verse 10, there were 135,000 of them. They camped in the valley of Jezreel. They were up there in the strategic northern highlands of Israel. And I'm sure each one of those Midianites was looking to the other and saying, ah, usual job. They're pretty battle-hardened now. They're veterans at this kind of thing. For the 8th time they are doing it. And they expected to do today what they had done over the past 7 years. Run in there, into the land of Israel. Strip the land with no fear of any strong opposition. Then return jubilantly to their own desert homes. It would be straightforward, simple. What could be easier? It was not going to be easy this year, though. God had been working behind the scenes. God had been in Israel here, raising up a man, Gideon, who was now prepared to lead Israel against the forces of Midian. And Gideon, empowered by the Spirit of the Lord, had mustered an army of 32,000 men, and he had marched them out, we are told in verse 3, onto the hills of Gilboa that's in the region of Gilead. Picture the scene. Midian is on the north, on the plain by the hills of Moreh. Between the two armies, there's a valley. In the valley, we have it described here as a well. It's actually a spring. It flows the spring of Harod. And that water, the water of Harod, was the only water available to Gideon's men. To get out there and drink it would have been quite an adventure. A man out of Gideon's army had to go forward in full view of the enemy. The lush growth of reeds and of shrubs around the spring of Harod would make an ambush a constant possibility. So to get your thirst quenched or even your face washed would have been a pretty daunting exercise. From his vantage point across the valley, Gideon could most likely see a large part of this Midianite army. It was a terrifying sight. Notice the description of it in Judges 7, verse 12. And the Midianites, and the Amalekites, and all the children of the east, lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude. And their camels were without number as the sand by the seaside for multitude. So we've got 135,000 men who were armed to the teeth. And all that Gideon had were 32,000 men who virtually had no weapons between them. It was slightly imbalanced, to say the very least. I can only imagine his feelings. Lord, Gideon would have been saying, how are we going to do it? We don't really stand a chance. There's not enough of us. Don't have enough people here. A little boy was wakened up by a nightmare that he'd had about 3 o'clock in the morning. He called out, Daddy, Daddy. His father answered, as you can imagine, rather groggily, and said, what is it? I've had a bad dream, the boy says. I'm scared. The father responded, go back to sleep, son. It was just a dream, but I want you to come and be with me, the little boy said. Daddy groaned, just go back to sleep, son, he says. God is with you. After a little silence, the boy replied, but I want somebody with skin on. On our journey of faith, we have bad dreams and nightmares and troubles at times. We're scared. We cry out in the night and we want to hang on to someone with skin on. And I'm sure that's how Gideon felt here. And Gideon felt, we don't have enough skins around us. We don't have enough people to do battle against these Midianites. And when he thought that, God came in and he uttered one of the most stunning sentences any man ever heard. Judges 7 and 2 records it. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many. Too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands. Gideon, you've too many people. We'll need to scythe this army down. You're too large. Now, if it hadn't been the case before, it was definitely the case now that faith was in the crucible, right there in the melting pot, and the heat was really being applied. What a test this was going to be. God tests our faith for two basic reasons. To show us, number one, whether our faith is real or whether it's counterfeit. It's always the case that a faith that cannot be tested cannot be trusted. Faith is much, much more than just a warm, fuzzy feeling. It must be substantial, it must be solid, it must be based and founded upon something that won't shake. And then again, he tests our faith to strengthen it for the service that he sets before us. The child of God will often find the Lord taking him and putting him down through that valley of testing before he will ever allow him to scale up onto the mountain peaks of victory. And here's a truth that we need to get hold of, and it rises out of the middle of Judges 7 and verse 2. God is not interested in merely bringing victory to his people. He is anxious to teach us trust. Yari Indrig has said, if our victories make us self-reliant, they are ultimately more disastrous than defeat. Now, we've learned that, I'm sure, on occasions in the past, and we'll be learning it again and again and again until we set our feet on the shores of glory. We can trust in the Lord. We can see him do good things for us. There will be growth. There will be progress. There will be expansion. These things can be seen. And other people look up to us and they thump us on the back and they tell us, you're doing a great job. Just keep it up there. And that's all it takes for us to stop, to look around us, to start congratulating ourselves. Oh yes, we tell ourselves, look at all that I've done, and we siphon off the credit that is due to the Lord only. All too often, we are like that King Hezekiah, 2 Chronicles 6, 26, verses 15 and 16. We're told he was marvelously helped, till he was strong. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction, for he transgressed against the Lord his God, and went into the temple of the Lord to burn incense upon the altar of incense. He felt he is untouchable here. He's impregnable. He is the guy that's causing it all to happen. And this is what Judges 7 verse 2 is all about. To stop those boasts rising from the hearts of the Israelites, once the victory over the forces of Midian has been achieved, to stop them parading themselves and saying, what a brilliant bunch we are. God steps in and he demands a troop reduction. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest, here's his reason, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. A pompous young man received a medal at school. The person who presented the medal to him used very extravagant language to praise the student's accomplishments. And so, proud as a peacock, the young man came home and he repeated all the words verbatim to his mother. He said this about me, and he said that about me, and he said the other thing about me. Hey, isn't that great? And then he asked, how many great men are in the world today anyhow? His wise mother said, one less than you think. I like to think of it this way. We cannot be too small for God to use, but we can be too big. If we want the credit for what God is doing, then God will not use us. He declares in Isaiah 42 and 8, my glory will I not give to another. He wants the glory. He doesn't want there to be any confusion between what we are doing and what he is doing, and that's why he reduces our resources. The implication is here that you cannot be too small for God to use you, but you can certainly be too big. I look around me and see that God is working, mightily working, in the lives of some naturally weak people. The world looks on these people and they say, no natural talents, no raw ability even, no gifts. But God is using them to His glory, and this is why they are small enough for God to use. I find the words of Spurgeon very interesting here. There are many people, he says, who would not kill a mouse without publicizing it. Samson killed a lion and said nothing about it. Say much of what the Lord has done for you. Say little of what you have done for the Lord. Do not speak a self-glorifying sentence. And that's the truth that's being emphasized and underlined to Gideon and to his forces here. And some people I know are bothered by the thought as they view it that, well, I'm not very significant. They're discouraged even to find that they have no gifts as they view it. Praise God for that if you think that's the case. Lift your eyes to Him. He will be more than pleased to use you in His service, for you're exactly the type of person that He delights to get a hold of. But if we sit here thinking, God is very fortunate that He has a character like me to call upon, a man, a woman of ability, of natural talents, I can do this, I can do that, I can do the other thing, I can do everything, then we are heading for a big letdown. Look carefully at the two tests God subjected Gideon's army to, so that He could fashion them into the fighting force that He wanted them to be. There was first of all a test of fearlessness. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 20, verses 1 to 4, and then again verse 8, God had drafted up some battle plans for Israel to guide them as they went out against their enemies. And He said, be not afraid of them. He said again, let not your hearts faint, fear not, do not tremble, neither be ye terrified because of them. And then He went on to say, in verse 8 of Deuteronomy 20, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. And that's what we have here in Gideon's case. He's putting that previous battle plan into operation, prompted by God to do it, of course. Pride after the battle will rob God of the glory, but fear during the battle will rob God's soldiers of courage and power. Fear is infectious, very infectious. One timid soldier standing there in the ranks, shaking like a leaf, can do more damage than a whole company of the enemy soldiers that are coming in against them. Fear and faith cannot live together in the same heart for too long. Either fear will conquer faith and we will quit, or faith will conquer fear and we'll go out there and be victorious. An obstacle appears in our lives. The Lord comes with the promise of His presence and of His power. He says, I'm with you. I'm fighting for you. Don't be afraid. And you know what? If we continue to be afraid and we shake and we tremble on, the Lord will not send us into the fight. He will remove us, for this fear is contagious, and He will commission somebody else to go forward and do the task. Fear focuses on the problem and sees very little else. Faith focuses upon God and wonders what the problem is. Faith. Mighty faith, the poet says, the promises, and looks to God alone, laughs at impossibilities and cries, it shall be done. John Wesley might have been thinking of Gideon's reduced army when he said on one occasion, give me 100 men who fear nothing but sin and love nothing but God, and I will shake the gates of hell. Can you imagine what it would have been like to stand where Gideon stood when God announced in chapter 7, verse 2 here, the people that are with thee are too many for me, to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me? Can you imagine being Gideon there? What it felt when he looked round and he sees 2/3 of his army just melting away in front of his eyes, 22,000 people leaving. If Gideon's faith had been in the size of his army, and even to begin with, he had only 32,000 men, that didn't sound too safe against 135,000. But even then, if his faith had been weak, then his faith would have been instantly weakened and dramatically weakened with the departure of a further 22,000, as he viewed it, vital men. I'm sure Gideon, when he announced this, anybody who's frightened, fearful, well, you can go home. He would have expected a few people to break out of the ranks and go away and cower off. But surely not such a massive chunk of his army. His heart now must be well dying in his boots. However, God hadn't completed this testing process yet. More is to come, and it's further bad news for Gideon, because he has now an even greater test of his faith. If the first was the test of fearlessness, then we've got a second test, the test of fervency. Fervency. This time, well, we know the story. God tells Gideon to send your 10,000 men that remain down to the spring here that's in full view of the Midianite army, the enemy, to drink water. Gideon was to take careful note of how they drank. Some, he was told, they'll scoop up the water with their hand, holding the spear with the other hand. They will lap the water like a dog. Others will fall down on their faces, forget about everything that's around them, and they will drink on both their knees to the full faces in the water. And nobody but Gideon knew what was happening here. The only thing the army realized was that they had been told that they should get a drink of water. They had no idea that anything more significant than that was taking place. And even Gideon didn't know whether God would point to the lepers or to the kneelers here. Now surely that tells us something. God tests us when we're not even aware of it. Like the traffic police, who stand with their hair dryers at the side of the road in some deceitful spot. Unexpected. The Lord doesn't always come out and put signs up and line marker cones along the route of our lives, making it clear to us a test is in progress. But it is those secret tests that reveal what we really are. What we do in private tells the story of the real me. What do you like in private? Loyal to the Lord or to your lusts in the secret place? Do you pass God's test when only His eye is upon you? The attitude of Gideon's soldiers to their enemy was revealed in even this small matter of the way that they drank the water from the brook. Most of the soldiers had their minds on nothing other than task at hand, that immediate task, getting a drink of water, and they forgot as they took that water all about Midian. And yet 300 men, 3% of the 10,000 who were left, they had a different mind. They knew, we are so close here to the enemy camp. We are liable to come under attack through an ambush. And they were not going to take their eyes off the enemy. They were not going to take their hands off their weapons. And in this time of war that they were engaged in, they were not going to lose sight of their central purpose. They would not take unnecessary risks, even here, with life's necessities. It has been said there were 32,000 faithful men who were willing to fight. There were 10,000 men who were fearless because they had a God who was greater than their enemy. But these 300 men were fervent, committed wholeheartedly to engaging the enemy in battle. There's a word used here in verse 5 to separate, and it describes the filtering out of inferior elements in the refining of metals, and that's how the enemy, or the army here of Gideon, was reduced. So God puts his hand on less than 1% of the fighting force that was available to take on the Midianites. 300 men going out now to battle against 135,000. They were outnumbered 450-1. We read about the heroism tied up in the battle of the Alamo, but the odds then were never so heavily weighted as this. Probably like a primary school rugby team taking the field against a full-strength Leeds Rhinos rugby league club and beating them 52-0. The words of Churchill spring to mind that he spoke concerning the RAF in World War II. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. This was a small group of men now whittled down to the absolute bare bones and below it, because God had stripped away everything that would keep them back from trusting in Him. And why did He do it? Well, He reduced the army to such a size so that they now had no options but to trust in the Lord. They could either totally depend upon the Lord or perish. Their only hope now lay in the Lord. So we have faith in the crucible. Very quickly, we have, secondly, fortification in the contender. Fortification in the contender. I can't imagine, with all of this having taken place in front of him, that Gideon was lying down that night and thinking, I'm going to sleep well here. Who could have? Only 300 left out of 32,000 to face 135,000. That thought alone was enough to give his mind a real wobbly. And then, in the middle of the night, God comes to Gideon again. Brings a command to him, brings a promise as well. Judges 7, the verse 9, "And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, Arise, get thee down unto the host, for I have delivered it into thine hand." Arise, he said. Get up out of your slumber. The Lord knows how he feels. The Lord knows Gideon now needs a boost to his courage, a prop to his faith. He had to deal with the fear that was lurking in Gideon's heart, and he does deal with it. Verses 10 and 11, "But if thou fear to go down, go thou with Phurah of thy servant down to the host, and thou shalt hear what they say, and afterward shall thine hands be strengthened to go down unto the host." Then went he down with Phurah his servant unto the outside of the armed men that were in the host. See what was happening here. Look very carefully. God had already told Gideon, and we have noted this in previous messages, he had told Gideon three times that he was going to make Israel victorious. Judges 6, verse 14, "You'll have the victory." Judges 6, verse 16, "You'll have the victory." Now again, Judges 7 and the verse 7, "You will have the victory." Three times he has been told that. God reassured him as well by giving him three special signs. Sign number one, fire from the rock. Judges 6, 19 to 21. Sign number two, the wet fleece in Judges 6, 36 to 38. Sign number three, he gave him the dry fleece in Judges 6, 39 and 40. Now, after all of this divine help, this encouragement, this assurance and reassurance, you would have thought Gideon would be strong in his faith. He'd be really solid now. He'd be getting out there among the enemy, but not so. And therefore God, in great patience and in great grace, he understands him. He remembers that Gideon is only dust and flesh. He doesn't condemn him. He sympathizes with his weaknesses. He gives him more grace, and he further encourages him. How does he do it? In two ways, by giving him another promise. Judges 7, verse 9, "And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, Arise, get thee down unto the host, for I have delivered it into thine hand." Now this is the fourth time that God was saying, "I am delivering the Midianites into your hand." It's an old cliche, but it is so true. God says it, I believe it, that settles it. And here Gideon could go out in faith on God's promise. He gave Gideon another sign. And so in verses 10, right through to 14, we'll not read them all there, that sign is given. Another sign. Gideon and Phurah, his servants, set off for the enemy camp. They slide and slink across the valley into the outskirts of the Midianite camp. They come up to one of the tents and they catch a conversation. Floating in the air, two Midianite soldiers, they're up, sitting upright in the beds, they're talking, and they're both sounding very worried. They have just awakened out of sleep, and one of them has had a dream there in the camp of Midian. "Hey," he says, "I've had a wild dream. I saw a little cake of barley bread, it bounced down the hillside, it hit one of our tents, it flipped it over, it flattened it. Hey, what do you think of that?" And immediately his scared friend was awake to what that dream signified, and he says, "This is nothing else. See, of the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hands hath God delivered Midian and all the host." For the fifth time, out of the mouth of an enemy soldier this time, God is telling him, "I am delivering the Midianites into your hand." And this is a rather remarkable little dream. Barley, that loaf of barley bread that was seen in a dream, bouncing down the hillside, barley was a good picture of Israel. It was the food closely associated with poor people. The Midianites had stolen their wheat for the past 7 years, reduced them to barley eaters, animal food. And the picture here is that of a steel, hard cake that could roll like a wheel. A good picture of Israel, not in the least complimentary. Then the tent in this man's dream was a symbol of the Midianites, those desert people who lived in tents. But the glorious news was this, that little barley cake was going to tumble down that mountain onto the camp of the Midianites, onto their tents, topple them and crush their army. What a story this is for Gideon to hear. On the eve of this momentous battle, when all the odds are stacked against them, it came as a glorious encouragement. I marvel at the providence and sovereignty of God right here. For this incident reminds me that he is in total control of even the smallest affairs of men. Think of it, he told Gideon to go down to the camp of the Midianites and hear what they were saying. He protected Gideon, Phurah, so that he were not detected or slain by any of the enemy guards. He brought Gideon to a particular place on the outskirts of that enemy camp, to the tent of these two Midianites. He led them there, and at the very moment one of the Midianites wakened from his dream and began to spill the contents of it to the other one about it. He allowed them to hear the nature of the dream and the interpretation of it. Coincidence? Just a chance occurrence? No way, this is sovereignty. There is no other reasonable explanation for it. I'm sure that as Gideon listened into the words and heard his own name used, no less, by this Midianite, this is nothing less save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hands hath God delivered Midian and all his host. Gideon must have realized here, like never before, that this was not a battle between 300 Israelites who were on his side and 135,000 Midianites on the other side. This was a battle much more than this. God was on their side. And Gideon, his servant, was gradually forming in his heart and in his mind a vivid picture of the greatness of God. Daniel asserted in Daniel 11:32, the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And we can never do anything for God. We can never be victorious for Him until first of all we get a picture of God formed in our heart, formed in our mind, of how truly great He is. And now Gideon's heart is inflamed with encouragement, inflamed with faith, and he goes back to the camp of Israel, and God stirs up that flame to rise to the dimensions of a towering inferno. For God says to him in verse 15, and it was so, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof, that he worshipped and returned into the host of Israel and said, arise. Notice where the spotlight is, for the Lord hath delivered into your hand the host of Midian. God, confidence, would win the day. So we have faith in the crucible, fortification in the contender, and we have finally fear in the camp. God not only worked on Gideon and his army, building them up through reducing their numbers, but he got to work on the Midianites as well. He sowed the seeds of fear within their hearts. That's the only way you can describe and explain the actions in Judges 7, 13 and 14, that God was in there and he was sowing the seeds of fear within those Midianites. Those Midianites would have been well aware of the dramatic happenings in the Israelite camp. They would have watched as an army of 32,000 men became an army of 22,000 men, became an army of 10,000 men, became a tiny band, 300 men strong. They would have seen that massive reduction in resources. Well, why then should an army that has seen this, and an army that has 135,000 men at its disposal, well equipped with a lot of weaponry, plenty of camels there, why should it be afraid of 300 men with a few proper weapons to call upon? Why would they tremble? The answer can only be that Almighty God had filled their hearts with fear. He had already softened up the men of Midian for Gideon. They were now easy prey. When the Lord calls us to do something for Him, go out to battle for Him against sin and wickedness and the devil, He always goes before us. He straightens the way. He removes the obstacles. He softens up the enemy. We sang today, onward Christian soldiers. And we, in those words of these ones, Christ the Royal Master leads against the foe. Forward into battle, see His banners go onward, Christian soldiers marching as to war, looking on to Jesus, who is gone before. Let us get ready to go, arise and attack, trusting in the Lord and in His promises. And remember, it is His triumph, His victory. He deserves all the glory. And it's significant here that Gideon stops to worship God before he did anything else.
He was so overwhelmed by the goodness and the grace and the mercy of the Lord that he fell on his face in submission and gratitude. You'll find that Joshua did the same thing before he took the city of Jericho in Joshua 5, 13 to 15. And to be victorious and to have the Lord with us, then this is a good practice for us to adopt. Own up to our own inadequacy. Let us have God take us down to the place where we must depend upon him. For when we do, what blessed results follow. We can never be too small for God to use. But remember, we may be too big.